Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. In December of 2017, the Barnstable County Sheriff's Department became the third sheriff's department in the state, along with Bristol and Plymouth counties, approved to participate in Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE's 287G program. The program trains sheriff department personnel to identify and process individuals in their custody who may have violated immigration law. Sheriff Jim Cummings says the program is about identifying criminality, not nationality, and is in the interest of public safety. Opponents have expressed a number of concerns, including local agencies doing the work of the federal government and immigrant right protections, and if this could prevent immigrants from coming forward to report crimes. Later in the hour, we talk with the executive director of the Immigrant Assistance Center in New Bedford to hear how Bristol County Sheriff Jim Hodgson's participation in the 287G program has impacted the immigrant community there. But first, we sit in on a public information session hosted last week by ICE and the Barnstable County Sheriff's Office and hear questions from residents about the program. On the panel with Sheriff Cummings is Assistant Superintendent Robert Ahoan and Lieutenant Corey Cameron from ICE Acting Field Officer, Office Director Todd Lyons, and Supervisory Detention and Deportation Officer Claudia English.
Good afternoon. Thomas Ryan. I'm the Chair of the Migrant and Refugee Committee for the Cape Cod and Islands Council of Churches. I thank you very much for the work that you do. I often talk to immigrant populations and to some of the spouses of the men who are arrested for domestic violence. So I understand the complexity of the question, even internal to immigrant communities. It's a very complex job you have. In the MOA, paragraph 17, called upon for community outreach and the involvement of external stakeholders in the work that you're doing. I'm happy you're having this meeting, even though it's at the furthest extremity of your county. Those from Provincetown have a bit of a journey. So thank you for this meeting. I know it's part of the community outreach, and I thank you for that. Some of the versions of 287Gs over the decades have included external stakeholders involved in your group, internal to the group itself. So I'm wondering if you've considered that, and would you consider that? Because a lot of us have grave concerns about a lot of things, and it would be better for us to communicate regularly than to just confront each other irregularly. Thank you.
So just to follow up to that, if anyone's interested in participating as an external stakeholder, you have a community. I know Mr. Ryan has a community that he would represent. Feel free to send us an email, and we'll make sure you're part of that discussion moving forward.
My name is Stephanie Simpson, and I would like for you to speak of the process in which INS, Immigration Naturalization Services, became ICE. It was a process, and one of the things that INS did was assistance with immigrants regarding becoming citizens. And from what I understand, that is not part of ICE, and I would like to know how that happened, and just for the sake of education and awareness, that people are aware that INS became ICE with all the federal funding after 9/11, if someone could speak to that. Thank you.
Sure. ICE came about after the 9/11 commission. In 2003, we were merged with Immigration and Naturalization Service and Customs, U.S. Customs, which was part of Department of Justice. Once we all became DHS, we became two separate entities. So there is Immigration and Customs Enforcement. But, ma'am, the section that you speak to is Citizenship and Immigration Services, who does apply services for getting green cards, processing visas such as U visas, S visas, and also as far as the citizenship process. So USCIS, their website is uscis.gov. They are the ones who handle the non-law enforcement matters, where INS used to be combined, which had a dual function of law enforcement and non-law enforcement related tasks. The 9/11 Commission recommended the founding of DHS in 2003 when the split began. That's when CIS became an entity that handles citizenship and immigration services.
Hello, I'm Maria Rudden from Harwich, and I have kind of a multi-part question. First has to do with what was said during the earlier comments, and that was that, in fact, ICE referred inmates are represented by attorney and get due process. Number one, who pays for that attorney? Is that taken on by the county, by the federal government, by the inmate himself or herself?
In the Commonwealth, for their criminal charges, the taxpayers provide an attorney for indigent folks.
And that attorney is provided for every single ICE detained inmate?
If they're indigent for their criminal charges, yes.
And indigent means what?
The probation and the courts of the Commonwealth would look into that, and they make the determination.
So an indigent person does get paid for by the taxpayers. Somebody that has money or has the means, how does that person get an attorney?
He would pay for it, or she would pay for it out of their own funds.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. And then with respect to due process, how can we as citizens verify that every single person who was referred to ICE was in fact given proper due process?
We listed all the folks who inspect us, and they certainly look at that. Also, you can call, I think as was suggested in the PowerPoint, your congressperson, or you can call ICE directly and ask them.
If you give all your ICE-referred inmates due process, how do we verify that, in fact, each ICE-referred inmate was given due process?
Just by those inspections or by asking any of those parties.
Uh-huh. And if we were to ask you, what's the turnaround time for getting an answer to those questions?
If you had a particular individual's name?
Yeah, you said there were 79 people who were referred in 2018, so we have 79 different questions. So how do we get those answers?
If you give us their names, you know, we could do them individually. But the illegal immigrants that come to our facility get the same rights and process as every American citizen who comes through there. There's no difference. As a matter of fact, for the most part, the staff doesn't know that they are an illegal immigrant. I mean, I think Lieutenant Cameron probably knows because he does the ICE stuff. But most of the other staff, they don't have any idea of what the criminal charges are or whether they're legal or illegal or anything like that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
My name is Teresa Parker, and I'm a reporter for the Provincetown Banner. And I wanted to understand a little bit more about one of your frequently asked questions about due process again. My question is to do with innocence, the question of innocence. Do I understand correctly that when you say people are given due process, that they are tried and convicted of their crimes before being turned over to ICE? What if someone is found innocent of his crime?
When they're arrested, they face their criminal charges here in the States, or here in the Cape. And if they're found guilty and they get a sentence, they serve that sentence, and at the end of that sentence, they would be turned over to ICE. The process to see if there's somebody who needs to be removed starts when they come into the jail. So,
is it the case that someone could be in your custody and be turned over to ICE by you, but be innocent of his crime?
Innocent of the criminal charge here in Massachusetts?
Yes.
Yes, they could.
And regarding the previous reporter's question about whether you are detaining people in some way that you're not supposed to be under because of the Lund decision, I wanted to know, it's not called an ICE detainer if your officer has been designated an ICE official, then that person can execute the same activity that would be done by, or would be illegal if done by someone who wasn't ICE. So with the 287G, you essentially enable one of our local sheriff's officials to work around the Lund decision. Is that right?
No, because a designated immigration officer can issue an I-247, which is immigration tenor. They can write that person up on the immigration charge. He can call us to come get that individual, but if we don't respond or we don't have an officer there, we won't take that person. We won't be able to take
them. So what is the difference between having the 287G agreement and not having it? That's what I'm trying to understand. That's kind of the bottom line question.
The Bristol model kind of has, they do have a 287G program where they are designated immigration enforcement officers. However, that is one of our long-term facilities for someone that is in immigration proceedings. Barnstable isn't. So there is no ICE presence on the Cape. So the sheriff having a 287G program assists us when identifying criminal aliens. However, he's not an integral part of the actual detention and long-term holding of criminal aliens, if that helps to answer your question.
Wayne Bergeron, Dennis, let me quickly add my thanks for doing this.
I know if somebody's arrested by the local police department on a Friday night, and they need to go ahead and put somebody somewhere because the judge won't be hearing until maybe Monday morning or once the week starts, they sometimes end up at the Barnstable County Jail. Do I understand that correctly? Just for that holding period, right? If they are there, does the process start then in terms of determining their legality within our country, or does it start after they go ahead and they meet with the judge for bail purposes Monday or Tuesday?
You know, we do, for the local police departments on occasion, we will take their lockups for them. Usually it's over a weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and if it's Monday's a holiday, that's the longest anyone will be there. And even though, you know, the process may start during that time period, depending if one of the trained officers happens to be working over the weekend, it takes longer than that to complete it. So if they went to court on Monday morning and got bailed, you know, that would be the end of it.
Okay. What was the process when somebody would come in and you had a reason to suspect that they may be undocumented? How have things changed other than the fact that you're now working with ICE? Somebody who is an immigrant and they show up in front of you prior to this, was there any concerns at all about whether they were documented or not? Did you have a process or was this relatively new with the partnership with ICE?
The biggest difference is if in your scenario where a lockup came in over the weekend, that person would be fingerprinted, as Mr. Lyons said, and if a hit went out through the ATIS system, the AFIS system, ICE could initiate their proceedings based on that. They have centers, I believe there's three. They could file a detainer on behalf of their agency. They would fax that to us. The biggest difference now is, in addition to that, somebody that comes into the facility, if they claim to be born in a foreign country, and one of the 287G trained officers were there, we would either conduct an interview or a screening and go from additional information gleaned from that. So it's a little bit more than just a fingerprint. I would say that's the biggest difference.
Jill Stewart from Eastham. Many of the towns on the Cape have been passing safe community resolutions and do not want to, you know, they want to follow the community policing methods, and they want it to be safe for people to come forward and testify and so forth. So we've sort of indicated we want to prioritize the many immigrants that are here, undocumented people. What is this program doing that helps prioritize? From what I've heard, as soon as they go in, they're arrested for anything. Now that all the police places have AFIS and they send it through, ICE has access to that immediately. And once you get in the system, then you guys are going to come in at some point unless you can't make it. That doesn't say anything about prioritizing violent criminals or anything else. It puts them right in the system, which means that in a community policing thing, even if we pass a safe community proclamation, they don't get that comfort of knowing that they are not going to be targeted for deportation. So I'd like to know what you are doing to prioritize. It's not happening at the border. Is it happening on the Cape where we're saying we'd like that priority to happen? And in regards to that, then my question to you, Sheriff, is of the 79 people that you've had there, what percentage have families? What percentage have lived here over a year who have been working in the communities? Do you have that information? No, so we're not looking at prioritizing.
I was going to say, if I can just give you like some basic breakdowns. As far as the 79 that the sheriff had talked about,
yes,
that was from January of 2018. The actual 287G program went active, or as I consider live, on June 13th of 2018. There was 56 encounters, which means that someone was screened for immigration purposes. Out of those, only 13 of those 56 were referred to us. Five were released from court, from not immigration court, but local or state court on their charges. They received bail or bond, and they were released back that day. Only two have been removed from the United States. One was formally deported because they were previously deported, and one returned to their country voluntarily. So out of those 79 encounters, only two have been removed from the United States.
And does that mean that once they were arrested and
waiting for bond or, you know, waiting for their court hearing if they didn't get bond, that you, that's only that many ever got referred to you, or are they now in the system, even though they may have been out on bail?
No, the 13 that were referred to us were all, I would say, mostly all felons, except for the exception of DUIs, operating on the influence. Out of the, I'm sorry, out of the 13 that I talked about, there are still 8 that are in either the sheriff's custody or the state of Massachusetts awaiting trial on their crimes. So as far as prioritization on the Cape, I honestly don't have enough officers to arrest every person that's arrested for no driver's license. We have to prioritize.
Good afternoon. I'm Reverend Jessica Clay, Senior Minister of First Parish Brewster Unitarian Universalist. I have a couple of points to make and a question. My first point is that people are not aliens. So using language from a law in 1956, there were a lot of laws in 1956 that were unjust. And so it is time to update our language because words matter. The way that we talk about people who are undocumented matters because chances are, as I look around this room, a lot of our ancestors came here undocumented. And so remembering that. Yes, yes, they were. And so somehow championing for immigrants has become not patriotic. And there has been a line drawn that says that if you are for immigrant rights and immigrant reform, you are not patriotic. And I would say it actually is patriotic.
Good afternoon, Peter Wasdorf from Falmouth. A couple of basic questions, if I may. Do I understand correctly that the participation of the Barnstable County Sheriff's Office with ICE is voluntary and at your initiative, Sheriff Cummings?
Yes.
And how many other sheriffs in Massachusetts or law enforcement agencies are participating with ICE?
Right now, there's myself in 2 other counties.
And what percentage would that be of the total?
Well, there's 14 counties.
If I understand correctly, there have been no new staff members added to the sheriff's office since their participation with the ICE program. Is there anything wrong with my logical conclusion that any staff time spent on working with ICE is therefore staff time taken away from general law enforcement?
No, it is an addition to their duties, but we have 4 officers that are trained, and currently we alternate them, 1 officer per week to do the ICE function, but they do that along with their regular duties, so it hasn't had any effect on our staffing whatsoever.
They're not working overtime, it's normal.
They are not.
I want to point out, in contradistinction to points made earlier, that study after study has shown that the percentage of people in undocumented immigrant communities participating in crimes is less than those of the rest of us U.S. citizens who participate in violent crimes. And the final point I want to make to follow up on what the minister is saying is we used to be a beacon for immigrants and now we're demonizing them. We used to be the country that countries looked up to for democracy and for establishing civil rights, and we have lost that, and it's a shame.
And, you know, I just remind you that we're only dealing with criminals that are also here illegally. If anyone has a suggestion, please tell me. What should we do with these people when they get finished with their criminal sentences? Should we release them back into your communities? Is there a place in your city or your town where we could send these folks?
You should be.
Hi, Maureen Tui Bedford, West Yarmouth. Thank you for having this. I think it's a great way for everybody to get together and hear what everybody has to say. The word that I keep hearing, which is what you all deal with, is criminal first. I don't care whether somebody's undocumented or documented. Criminal is criminal, and I think you're addressing it properly. It seems like you have a system in place. I'm from New Jersey. If this happened in New Jersey, we have the Meadowlands. If people would not benefit from all these steps that are in place, And so I think that this is something that's good. My grandparents came from Ireland. They had to come here documented. They could not come here with a criminal background. They could not come here as a sexual predator or any of the other very significant crimes that were listed in the presentation. So I have no questions. I'm just a member of the community, and I like that you're keeping our community safe. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Eileen Kerwin. I'm from Falmouth, Massachusetts, and I just had one question about legal liability. I know that your ICE representative was saying that, like, you're not holding anyone after their criminal charges have been dropped, but say something happened by mistake that was unconstitutional. I'm just curious which entity in your process as like an ICE deputized ICE agent, who would then be at liable if any kind of actions were taken? Would it be ICE or would it be the sheriff's office, and ultimately our responsibility to pay for?
I'm liable. I'm the one that would be on the lawsuit.
Hi, my name is Angela Carbone, and I live in West Yarmouth. And I want to get back to something that was said earlier, and that was that the officers who are working with ICE but who are in the sheriff's department are not working overtime in order to do their job as ICE officers. Is that correct? Did I hear that correct? So that means that the hours that they spend doing that, they're not doing the normal jobs that your sheriff's office is sworn to do in terms of the general public. And since they have all that free time, and you haven't had, I know that's really stretching it. I understand it's not free time, but there are hours that they could be spending doing something else. You haven't had to add overtime. You haven't had to add personnel. And I'm wondering what is falling by the wayside because the ICE is taking precedent.
Well, it's the job we have, even with citizens. What they're doing relative to ICE, in my opinion, is keeping our community safer, and that's what my job is. So they're doing the job that I was elected to do as sheriff, by keeping our community safer, by identifying these people and turning them over to the proper authority.
I also want to just very briefly say that someone had the idea that the people who are undocumented immigrants are here not working and are living off of the U.S., and that's simply not true. I understand that businesses are told not to hire people who are not documented, but they do. It's illegal. Yes, it is. But they work in the kitchens. They work as maids. They work in all the jobs that a lot of people don't want to do. And
Trump
persons. They are here. They are working. They are not collecting unemployment. They are not collecting welfare. They are not.
Yeah, I guess that's it. Thank you all for coming. And I would offer anybody at any time that has a question, please don't hesitate to call us. And if you would like a tour of the correctional facility to actually come inside and see what we're doing, we can certainly accommodate that as well. Thank you.
That was some of the Q&A from last week's public forum presented by ICE and the Barnstable County Sheriff's Office. Should mention about 200 people in attendance, pretty evenly divided on those who support the program and those who do not. Coming up after break, State Representative Dylan Fernandez joins us to talk about the status of the Safe Communities Act, which would end partnerships between local law enforcement agencies and ICE. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE's 287G program. And joining us now is State Representative Dylan Fernandez, who's a co-sponsor of the Safe Communities Act. Before we get to that, we heard a lot of mention in the forum about the Lund decision. So for folks who are going, what is that? Tell us what the Lund, because this Safe Communities Act was introduced last session, but that was before the Lund decision. Yeah. So tell us about the Lund decision.
Yeah, and actually the Safe Communities Act was proposed even the session before last, but gained a lot of attention last session, especially after all of the really toxic rhetoric from the Trump administration around immigrants. But just to talk about the Lund decision a little bit and how that plays into the new bill, Mr. Lund was born into a Thai refugee camp. He then came to America when he was about 7 months old, lived here as a resident for around 30 years, and I believe a couple of years ago was arrested for robbery, but those charges were eventually dropped. But he had a civil immigration detainer issued against him from ICE, and so he was held even after his charges were dropped, and he was held because of that ICE detainer. So he wasn't held because of any criminal reason, and it's a reminder that ICE detainers are not criminal. They are civil. And in fact, for an ICE detainer, you don't need a criminal warrant. There doesn't need to be probable cause. It doesn't need to be signed off by a judge. This issue of holding someone just because of their immigration status was taken to court, and Mr. Lun won. And so our Supreme Judicial Court said that you cannot hold someone in Massachusetts, law enforcement cannot hold someone solely based on their immigration status. And now there is an exemption for that, and that exemption is if the law enforcement agency has a 287G agreement with ICE. And it just so happens that in all of New England, there are only four law enforcement agencies that have 287G agreements with ICE, and they're pretty much all down in our neck of the woods.
Plymouth, Bristol, Barnstable, and then with the Department of Corrections.
And the Department of Corrections, that's correct.
Correct. So tell us about the Safe Communities Act, what it would do, what it is.
Sure.
And it's
so,
changed a little bit because
It's gone through several different iterations. So the latest bill takes into consideration the Lund ruling and simplifies kind of the past bills. And so there's two main components. The biggest component is basically it just bans 287G agreements. Then the second most important component is that it allows for due process rights. And so just remembering that immigration violations are civil issues. That means that you're not automatically for these immigration cases. An undocumented immigrant who's being detained doesn't automatically get the right to an attorney, and they're not read their Miranda rights. And so in this piece, in the new Safe Communities Act, we make sure that law enforcement are informing folks who are detained on an immigration detainer about their legal rights and allowing them to get an attorney. They have to pay for it themselves. It's not court appointed because it's civil, not criminal. And they're also read their rights in their own language. And so, but the main component that I talked about earlier is the banning of 287G agreements.
But before I get to that, I just want to make one clarification, because people probably heard the sheriff say that the non-documented people who come through the jail there have the same process as anybody else, and that they for their criminal charges they do get an attorney. But you're talking about the civil charges. Okay.
Exactly.
I just want to make that clear. Okay,
exactly.
Okay.
And there's a lot of confusion around this, right? And rightfully so, because it's a confusing topic. But essentially what this piece does is that it bans all 287G agreements. That doesn't mean that someone who commits a crime is free to go. They still have to go through the entire criminal process that everyone else who commits a crime has to go through. It's just specific to the civil immigration issue, and says you cannot detain someone just because they are an undocumented immigrant in this country. If they commit a crime, they should be charged. They should be punished for the crime. And that nothing changes in that process. So why are 287G agreements bad? Well, for one, they actually make our communities less safe. And it's not just me saying that. The Massachusetts Coalition of Police Chiefs, the largest police coalition of 351 cities and towns, in our state came out in favor last session for banning 287G agreements. And to them, this is an issue of trust between law enforcement and the immigrant community. If immigrants and the immigrant community are afraid to come to law enforcement to report crimes because they think that their neighbor, their son, daughter, father could be arrested just because they're an undocumented immigrant, then they're not going to report those crimes. And so that's why the Massachusetts police chiefs came out in favor of ending 287G agreements. And also large groups that do work around sexual assault and domestic violence, Jane Doe being the kind of largest one in the state, is supportive of the Safe Communities Bill because we've seen in our state a downtick in the amount of reporting from domestic violence issues and sexual assault issues in immigrant communities because they're afraid to come forward to law enforcement. And so banning 287G agreements reestablishes trust between law enforcement and the local communities and makes our immigrant communities and just all of our communities in general more safe because people are more comfortable for reporting crimes.
Last year it passed the Senate last session on a budget amendment, but it didn't come up for a vote in the House. Mm-hmm. Governor Baker has said he would veto legislation if it came to him. So do you think there's support to not only pass this but override a veto?
I think that if it came up for a vote in the House, it would pass. And it already passed the Senate. And you know, there's a supermajority of Democrats in the House and the Senate. So there is the ability, certainly, to override the governor's veto. We do it all the time in Massachusetts. But I think that's a high hurdle. And there's certainly be a lot of vote counting going to effect if the governor decides to veto it. But I don't think the governor, I mean, it is our job as legislators to put ourselves on the record on hard issues. Mm-hmm. And regardless of whether the governor vetoes it or not, I think our constituents deserve to know where we come down on this issue. So I think it should come up for a vote. But one more point on why 287G agreements are bad, just to get back to the original point, is that, it allows county, state, local law enforcement to use county, state, and local resources to do the job of an ICE agent. And really, we have really tight budgets on the local level, state level, county level. We shouldn't be using resources that should be going to our own communities to be used to do the job of a federal immigration agent. And so there, when you think of detaining someone just based on immigration status, that costs money. When you think of combing through databases to look into someone's immigration status, that takes time and resources. And also, any time that someone is criminally booked, right, in Massachusetts, you go in, you're charged with a crime, you do your fingerprints, right. You get booked. That automatically goes into a database that ICE already is, already has access to. And so there already is kind of, you can call it a soft reporting to ICE of people who actually commit criminal acts.
All right. State Representative Dylan Fernandez, thanks for stopping in and giving us the status of that. Coming up after break, we're going to look at how the 287G program has impacted the immigrant community in Bristol County. You're listening to The Point. This hour, we're taking a closer look at the immigrant experience in our region after several county sheriffs initiated participation in the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Program's 287G program. The program trains sheriff department personnel to identify and process individuals in their custody who may have violated immigration law. Moving to Bristol County, Sheriff Thomas Hodgins applied for and received approval for ICE to have not only the 287G program, but part of the Bristol County Jail has been set up as an ICE holding and detention center. Joining us to discuss how the relationship between law enforcement and ICE has impacted the immigrant community is New Bedford's Helena Da Silva Hughes. She's the executive director of the Immigrants Assistance Center. She joins us on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So one of the things, I know you were listening, and one of the first speakers who got up talked about this working with external stakeholders, people who work with immigrant communities, and getting their input on a more regular basis. And the sheriff's office and ICE both said that they would welcome that. Is that something that you would see as happening, A, and be beneficial?
I think it is extremely beneficial. I really believe that the 287G is definitely preventing the undocumented immigrants, not just undocumented, just immigrants in general, from calling the police or reporting crimes, or even women who are victims of domestic violence afraid to come forward in getting restraining orders. And we see that. I get calls from families who are very concerned. And I really feel that it is preventing a lot of immigrants from reporting crimes, or for women from getting restraining orders in fear of being red flagged mm-hmm. by immigration. So that is something that is very concerning. And the fact that we have it, the 287Gs in Bristol County, we do see the impact that it has in our community, and especially with our New Bedford police, the chief of police. For several years now, there's been a lot of meetings with the chief of police with the undocumented population, basically saying that if you see a crime or if you're a victim of a crime, you need to call the police. And so there was these meetings that took place for several years to basically gain the trust of the immigrant population with the police department. And so to me, I always felt that when you did that people were coming forward. And then now, more than ever, I think that with the present administration, it has given opportunities for people who are, unfortunately, a lot of them anti-immigrant, a platform to come, keep talking about the 287G and talk about the criminal, right? So I think using criminals to basically identify the undocumented population, I think it is extremely unfair. And, for example, I think we all agree that we do not want criminals in our communities, and they should be prosecuted and they should be deported. I think we all agree. It's the fact is that now that we're talking a population, the immigrant population, who are have civil issues, and they're here undocumented, but that now they are afraid to come forward and call the police, which at the end of the day, it affects the community in general. So I think that is that's something that worries me, and we are definitely seen by the calls that I receive and by the people that come in, the immigrants that come in, that want to talk to me in particular and about these issues. And that to me is very concerning. And unfortunately, I am seeing that this issue is getting worse. Yeah. And that is that's a huge concern of mine.
So tell us a little bit more about the supports and services offered through the Immigrants Assistance Center. What do you do?
Okay, first of all, we're a social service organization that has been around since 1971. So we've been around for many, many years. So we are trusted members of the immigrant community. When I talk about the immigrant community, I'm talking about immigrants in general. I'm talking about legal permanent residents who are here, immigrants who are here legally. I'm talking about immigrants who have a U visa. Some of them they might have T visa, they might have any visas, okay? Or they might be TPS, temporary protective status, but a lot of the immigrants that we also see, we call it mixed immigration. When mixed immigration means maybe both parents are here undocumented, or maybe one parent is here with no status, but then their children are born in the United States. So that is that's where we call it. So we do have quite a few of those families that come in for services. So I would say that within due to the present administration, that our immigrant population that seek our services have increased. When I mean increased, so basically I would say we would serve about 7,000 immigrants. We're up to 12,000 per year. So they're coming in. So we're actually talking about legal permanent residents who are green card holders who've been here for many, many, many years, and a lot of them are now very interested in becoming U.S. citizens due to fear. It's great. We want people to become citizens and registered voters, and you know, and we definitely, that's something that we've always talked about. But I see that that increase of has definitely immigrants have definitely applied for citizenship, which is something that is extremely positive. But at the same time, we also have clients that come in because of other, you know, low income. We service a very large low income immigrant population that many of them may have one, two, or two, three jobs, and that they have, in order to meet the basic needs of their families, they might have to rely, they might maybe on food stamps or something. That's just an example. So we do, we definitely serve a large immigrant population that fits that status. And then we have a pretty large elderly population who've been here for many, many years, who are legal permanent residents, green card holders. Some of them have become U.S. citizens. These are people who basically came in to the United States in the 70s, and I'm just going to use Portugal as an example. They live, Portugal was under dictatorship. So we have until 1974, so we're talking about an elderly population that's been here for many, many years, who worked in textile, who unfortunately never made any, did not make, they were low income, and are now retired and rely on our services because a lot of them are illiterate in their own language. So they never learn how to speak English because they can't read and write in their own language. So they rely on the Center for Translation, Interpretation, helping them navigate through the complex health insurance and everything else that you possibly can think. And many times they come in because there's a lot of other issues going on in their homes. And so they might be having a domestic violence issue. They might have an issue of a family member that has maybe has a substance abuse problem. So it could be, or maybe a crisis that is happening in their in their home. And so that is a lot of the things that we do. We are at New Bedford High School, and we're working with the unaccompanied youth. So it's a population that have come through the border. Them, some of them have been abandoned by their parents, and now they're at New Bedford High School. And now they might have a third-grade education, but they're 16 or 15 years old, and now they're at New Bedford High School. So what we are doing is we are really working with them to make sure that, first of all, that they stay in school, and the importance of making sure that if they have attorneys, that they have attorneys who are immigration attorneys and not really scam. Because unfortunately, that is something that we're seeing too, is that unfortunately, attorneys who are not immigration attorneys all of a sudden became immigration experts because they know that there is immigration is such a hot topic. So that is something that we're also very, very concerned. So we're working very closely with the Attorney General's office to make sure that that they are reported.
Now, Helena, there have been reports of children being fearful to come to school. Is this what you're hearing from some of your clients?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that we are hearing, and that is one of the reasons we are actually doing emergency family preparedness. And so what I'm saying is that right after the present administration 2 years ago, we got a phone call from the superintendent of school saying, Helena, you need to come in and calm students down because a lot of the students are afraid. And we're talking a lot of them. We're at elementary school. A lot of these kids are coming into school and saying that they're afraid that their parents are going to be deported. So they were afraid to be in school because they thought maybe when they got home, their parents would not be there. And that is something, you know, when you have it, when you're as a child and you're in class, how can you focus on your education or focus on what's going on in the school, which you have no idea what's going to happen when you get home. And so to me, that is one of the main reasons when we started to really do this emergency family preparedness. And it's basically creating, there's a plan that we speak to immigrant families, especially the undocumented parents, about what they need to do in place, what they need to have a plan in place in case one of their family members gets picked up by immigration. Yeah. And so that is something that we've been doing in the schools. We're actually working with 20 different schools to be going into the schools. And when I talk about an emergency family preparedness, is an example is, for example, if one of their parents gets picked up by immigration, the other parent who is also undocumented cannot go and visit the family who their spouse is at the Bristol County, or an example, Bristol County, because they are afraid that they might get picked up
when
they go visit the parents. Another one is making sure that they have a plan in place, making sure that they have someone whom they trust that is a legal resident or is a U.S. citizen, that in case a parent or parents get picked up by immigration, there's someone that they trust, that they have given them authority, like a caregiver or an affidavit of support that basically gives them the right to take care of their children or send them, bring them to the doctors or bring them to school, and then eventually connect the children with the parents once the parents have been deported. And so these are the things, this is one of the things that these emergency family preparedness is working, is just to make sure, and a lot of times when we are talking to these immigrant undocumented families, you know, there's a lot of tears, and of course no one wants to feel, and what I always say is that it might not happen to you, but it is important for you to have something in place.
Have a plan,
Exactly. Plan. Yeah. It's not going to ease the anxiety of the children, of course, but at the same time, it's better to be safe than sorry.
Right. Now, we mentioned the Lund decision in July of 2017. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruled law enforcement officers in Massachusetts cannot hold a person based solely on a request from immigration officials. The case was called Lund versus the Commonwealth. Has that changed anything in Bristol County?
I don't think so. We understand, we are aware of it, but I think the fear
is still there.
This is what's important, is the fear and the anxiety, and this is something that is extremely real that we are seeing, is that the word immigration. You also need to understand that New Bedford, the Michael Bianco raid,
right?
The Michael Bianco raid in 2007, which is like, it's a scar that has never been healed.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, this, of what's happening with the present environment is afraid. So we have an immigrant population that is very much afraid of immigration. And what happened, especially during the Michael Bianco, where a lot of parents were separated from their children. And then they hear about what's happening with what's going on in the border and how some of these children, now these children now need to be, they don't know where their parents are or whatever all the issues. So this, the media also has, everyone is listening to the media, the ethnic media. So this is something that is always constantly in the forefront. So because of that, I think that is one of the reasons that that's all they hear. There's these buzzwords and sort of like this anti-immigrant. And unfortunately, they use criminal immigrants as a scapegoat to pass this 287G or to do this. I really feel that what you're doing is, if we want safe communities and the Safe Communities Act, that makes tremendous sense. Because if you're undocumented, or if you're even documented and you're a criminal, there is a process that you are going to get deported.
Right.
So I think they're just using criminals as a scapegoat to be able to justify for 287G.
And we'll be keeping our eye on that Safe Communities Act. And we're going to post a link with more information about the Immigrants Assistance Center at our website, capeandislands.org. Executive Director Helena DeSilva Hughes, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Have a great day.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.